Welcome, everyone. My name is Weasel. This is Simple Nomad. We're probably the two oldest members. Obviously, he would be, but the oldest members of the Nomad Mobile Research Center. We've been doing quite a bit of research for quite a few years and never finishing much of it. So here's a few things that we've actually gotten a chance to get through and get to the end with, and we'll go through that. All right. Basically, I guess what we were trying to do here with a plausible deniability toolkit was come up with something that basically goes beyond anti-forensics. The big problem with anti-forensics from someone who may be doing something that may get them in trouble at a later date or doing something that, for whatever reason, anti-forensics has a serious problem with removing possible alibis. And basically, if you can't prove that you were somewhere else, therefore it's just as feasible that you were doing what you're accused of as opposed to what you may or may not have been doing instead. So we wanted to go through and kind of identify basically a methodology, a methodology to help people come up with a good game plan for doing the things that we like to do without possibly looking like we're doing them.
And the whole point of this is to basically get you thinking, all right? Basically start you in a thought process that makes you aware of what it is that when you're using the computer, when you're doing what it is, what you do. In a lot of cases, a lot of us as researchers, we do things that maybe on the surface even just look suspicious, even though we're well within our legal rights to be doing so. And then when you start talking about perhaps you're traveling internationally or something like that, going into extremely hostile environments, then you've got a completely different scenario there. So we wanted something kind of broad and general we're going to delve down into, I think, enough detail that's actually going to hold your interest.
And a lot of these methods are very useful for people trying to expand their skill set while they're at work. So that's what we'll definitely hope to find some room here. Okay, clarifications. This is not a rolled toolkit in the classic sense. Really, I guess what we were looking at is verbiage that actually fit for what we were doing, but it's not really a downloadable set of tools. Obviously, the big problem there is that you create a fingerprint when something's downloadable and pre-rolled and does specific functions or has a specific function. What we wanted to do was move towards something that would have legitimate uses, something that is dynamic, and something just methods that work without actually saying this person's trying to hide what they're doing. So
yeah, if we had a tarball of the plausible deniability toolkit, .tgz, and then you download that, and someone finds that in a forensic investigation on your laptop, any type of alibi, legitimate or not, would probably go away at that point.
And we do understand the entertainment value of creating such a toolkit and seeing all the idiots get popped for it, but we thought we would try and watch people's back this time around because, I can't imagine just how fun that would be just to see how many people get fired because WebSense updated their hacking category to include the URL to any kind of plausible deniability toolkit. So it's like how to murder my wife Google searches. It doesn't work. You don't do it. It's not right. Murdering your wife, okay. Don't search on how to do it. Okay. EFF has a booth. I recommend finding it. And
they're right there. They're right there.
Oh, well, there you go. EFF's right here.
They're in the room. Uh-oh.
Wife. We'll use that term. It just, significant other. Someone who drives you fucking crazy. Just whatever. It doesn't have to be female. It doesn't, whatever. All right. So, as I've already gone over, is PDTK is not anti-forensics, although it does use many of the, it can feasibly use many of the methods used in anti-forensics. But don't get the two confused. Don't think that the two are the same. Let's see. think we covered everything.
Yeah,
and I kind of covered the point that, you know, when you just take an anti-forensic mentality when you're doing the things that we do, as I said, you really cover up alibis. You really cover up a lot of very important information you might want to leave behind that you would like to be there. So, okay.
By the way, our goal is to get heckled by the EFF on almost every slide.
So,
just so you know.
Let me get my tip sheet going here. All right. The objectives: provide methods to use to the users to reduce threat of incrimination. Obviously, we'll go pretty quick through the first few slides, or just to make sure that we get the points out that we want to get in the beginning. Bring forward technologies for legitimate uses, such as protecting activists and whistleblowers that have most likely been used in the underworld for years. Yeah, but most of the technologies and stuff that you would use in plausible deniability are not new technologies. You're not going out looking for new tools. You want to use old tools. You want to use established tools. You want to use legitimate tools. Why would you go through and say, you know, download a I-didn't-do-it.bin, and it's, you know, there, it's obvious you did something wrong. You're doing something wrong or shouldn't be doing what you're doing. So, let's see. Yeah, specifically that.
No, let's go ahead. Let's keep moving forward.
Yeah. Okay. Here's some concepts for PDTK as data generation, specifically like logs, deleted files, fun stuff like that, where you basically go through and create files that give the appearance that something happened as opposed to what actually may have happened.
And this is kind of a tricky. Tight wire to walk, because if you're going to actually go to the trouble to construct actual evidence that you think is going to exonerate you, in theory, it's got to be above your current skill set.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You don't want to claim the hacker defense if you're a hacker, simply because, you know.
Yeah, and we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, we'll go into more details there. Data tampering, you know, altering data to get it to twist the bits a little bit and make the data more in your favor instead of against your favor. That could be anything from, you know, editing WTEMPs, the stuff that we've been doing for years, all the anti-forensic stuff and so forth, all the way to tampering data on other people's machines and maybe pointing an investigation in a different direction than yourself.
I want to make a couple of points on this. When we're talking about pointing things in different directions and whatnot, just to kind of really start to bring this home, what we're talking about here is what we refer to as lost keys syndrome, and that is if you've lost your keys and then you find them in the living room, then you usually stop looking for your keys at that point.
Always in the last place.
Yeah, you don't start going, you know, I think I'm going to check the kitchen just to make sure. That, you know, because you've already got them. And what happens in a lot of cases during a forensics investigation is that once they find what looks like the evidence that they are wanting to find,
which you didn't do,
then that's where the investigation will probably stop at that point, because they've got like huge caseloads and there's always tons and tons of work for them to get through, and they're going to go through these things in a big hurry.
Okay, let's go through a little bit more specifics of the tools we wanted to bring out here. Forensics tools and books alone are bad.
This is like if you've got if the only thing that you've got at your house, if you're doing bad stuff, you know, like it's a whole bunch of tools and books on anti-forensics, and someone comes and kicks in your door, then it's going to be, oh, well, look at that. That's the kind of stuff that will be taken in as evidence. Now, what's sad about this is if you're doing stuff that's actually legitimate work, okay, this could still possibly be used as a what's, I guess, referred to as indirect or circumstantial evidence as opposed to, you know, I mean, the book didn't commit the crime, you know, but nonetheless, the book is suggesting that you, just because you're in this particular mindset. And so, I mean, another one specifically is talking about the books. Also, like, it's it seems to me that it would be pretty much normal, and this is probably the case for everyone here, that we collect a lot of security books and whatnot, so we're going to have, you know, a pretty big library, and it would not be beyond the stretch of, you know, the imagination that you're going to actually have some forensics books, maybe some anti-forensics books. You will have stuff in there. As far as your collections of tools, I mean, if you're focused specifically on forensics and anti-forensics and that's all you have, that could potentially look bad. Now, having something like, and I've seen this a lot here, is Backtrack, which is fairly popular, and it has some forensics tools on there. Being in the possession of that Backtrack CD that, or the distro, and have it, you know, put it on your hard, you put it on your hard drive or whatever, that's not too unusual, particularly if you're doing research, if you're a pen tester, that type of thing. This is something that would be considered a part of your arsenal for you to actually do your legitimate job.
Yeah, and if you've got forensics and anti-forensics books in your library, don't highlight methods that you'll be using. I mean, it's just a gimme. These are your slides.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of tools that already exist on the systems that you can use. You know, there's various things like I mentioned, like hex editors, DD. There's a lot of different tools that if you start looking and playing with and seeing, okay, well, I know this is how this particular tool works. I know this is how these types of forensics tools work, and really learn how these things actually happen. You get kind of a real feel for what you can do. Now, the whole idea here is that, you know, you've got control of your system. You have physical control of your computer, correct? So you should be able to, at that level, at a very low level, be able to make changes on their very, very low level type stuff. Now, if you're able to do that and you understand how the forensics tools work, you can conceivably control the flow of the forensics investigation. Okay? You see, that's kind of roughly the point we're getting at here. You're controlling the flow of the investigation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, let's back up one slide. Yeah, I mentioned here like FISC, okay, on here, and this basically what FISC normally does on most systems is it's looking for to make sure that the inode stuff are all, that we don't have orphans, and it's basically looking for a parent. And a common old school thing was to you're going to create basically loops between inodes, and when it's time to get to that data you've hidden, then you reconnect things, and then now you can get to it, and then maybe you undo it and hide it again. This can work both ways. Maybe that's something that you may want to leave in place, and there's something in there that's like, you know, evidence of a rootkit is hidden in something like that, where all of a sudden where, and you leave it there where a forensics investigation may or may not uncover it. And we'll get into that a little bit deeper where the, you know, the defense forensics investigator may find something, and you may want him to find it as opposed to the prosecutor or whatever. But, I mean, but you want it to be found, that kind of thing. Keep that in mind when we're talking about these types of techniques where you're squirreling away various bits and bytes on your systems.
Right, and if you're trying to guide that investigation and whatnot, the last you want to have the mentality that you want it to be found, but don't hide it so well that it can't be found, and don't make it so obvious that it's obvious what happened. The last thing you want to be doing is directing any kind of investigators verbally or any other manner after the fact of how to find this data, right? Don't go through and try to direct the defense team on, well, if you look in this location, you might find that maybe I was compromised. It's not going to work.
That kind of gives it up.
Right.
Which, you know, that basically pretty much, you're done. Another interesting one, I don't know how many people here saw Matt Conover's, he did a presentation called Profiling Rootkits and Malware Through Executive Objects. This is a Windows thing. This is a really, really interesting, it was basically a method for modeling actions and stuff going on a Windows system. The purpose of it was by modeling what's going on, you can actually detect rootkits. The thing is that this could obviously be extended to actually be the rootkit itself. You know, kind of like the it's like a rootkit, a little bit different layer that you go in there with. this is the kind of thing where, you know, I would encourage if you, you know, if you're really wanting to squirrel away something and hide it, this may be a thing you may want to do. Now, if you're hell-bent on doing something goofy, or let's say you're going to be traveling overseas into hostile territory and you don't want, you know, evil government whatever to be stealing your laptop and getting all your zero day, then maybe you want to...
Canada.
Yeah, Canada, you know, because they're out to get us, okay? We know. We got NMRC members that are Canadian, and they're you know, it's fierce and ugly. But nonetheless, I mean, you want to make sure this stuff is safe. Hiding stuff in there might be a good idea. And at the same time, if you've got this rootkit in there that legitimately you install it, you know, today, and then let's say in 2 years or so you're going to CanSec West and the Mounties grab you, okay, and they do the forensics on your laptop, maybe things have caught up and now this type of, you know, these executive objects rootkits are now detectable, okay? So now it's detected, now it's there, and there you have it. Particularly, and we'll get into this a little bit more, particularly if your core skill set is in, you know, Linux, but you're taking the Windows laptop because you're doing a presentation at a conference, for example. Not that
not
we're saying
laptop.
That there's anything on this laptop and we didn't do anything bad.
And I don't know anything about Windows.
Yeah, we don't know anything about Windows at all.
Okay. Legitimizing tools. We kind of touched on this already, and I think we've actually probably don't even need to stop on this slide, but absolutely legitimize your tools. Your tools that you have in your possession have to have legitimate function. Do not. That's all I can say.
And this, again, yeah. This applies whether you've done anything bad or not.
Which you didn't and won't.
Correct? Oh, yeah, we... there's really no reason for this slide in the presentation.
And I did mess with the gamma to bring the dark areas up a little bit, but it was not pleasant. Bruce, are you in here?
Is Bruce here?
No.
Good. We got more slides. We'll show you later.
Yeah, it's great. Okay, distribution. This gets a little touchy. You know, how do you get the functionality and the methodologies and all those fun things out to people who want to use them without, you know, creating a weblog that says they're looking for it? We don't quite know yet. We do know where we're going to store them. In the meantime, get them anonymously in any way you can. I noticed there were some kiosks over down the way a bit. If you can, you know, if you happen to have a spare credit card that may not be yours, feel free to, you know, use it, but I didn't tell you to do it. Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, you. I'm sorry?
Oh, yeah, the kiosk has a camera.
Over it. I mean,
yeah, there's no cameras in the casino
right.
No one will spot that, yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, if you're going to be doing this, consider using some privacy measures. I mean, even if you're, you know, seriously, even if you're just like, you're curious about what this is and you think, well, I'm never even going to need this type of material. We don't have much up there right now. We've got the presentation, including Bruce's crotch up there. But we will be adding a lot more over the next few days once we get past all the partying and whatnot. Use Tor. Tor is a wonderful tool that I encourage everyone to use. It's a good example of a use for it. I'm going to be looking at something that someone else might be considered questionable, and you know what? It's my goddamn business. If I look at it, I'm not, you know, caring what anyone else says. No one needs to know about it. Go ahead and, you know, use something like that.
Right.
And if anyone can come up with some alternate methods, how we might get some of this stuff out, we don't have to talk about it here in this room, but contact us afterward and we can come up with some other creative ways to, as this grows, that we can get more and more information out to people.
Right. And I guess feasibly, one distribution method would be on some of the other toolkits, like, I don't know, maybe Backtrack's a good place to put something like this. It does, as long as it doesn't sway the mass opinion that Backtrack would be used to hide evidence or change evidence, cover evidence, whatever. You know, maybe that's where a distribution like this belongs. But if anybody's got anything, please get in touch with us, and we'll try and see if we can push that along.
Go for it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Definitely. PDTK definitely has some misuse, primarily from entities that may want to set you up. I don't know how to fix that, but it definitely could be used in an evil manner. Specifically, if someone's wanting to, in like in a political case where you're in the log somewhere, someone may. I'm not saying that the feds that are here are corrupted in any way whatsoever or motivated to do anything other than bring us 100% justice. But if someone was on tight budget and needed to finish a case, and you had made enemies at conferences by bad-mouthing them and making statements like I just said to them, you might want to watch your back and make sure stuff's not going on. So, do your old-school diligent stuff and just kind of watch for things happening like that. Even if you've got to modify your tools to look at deleted files nightly and see if anything that was created was actually ever existed on the system, fun stuff like that. Presenting yourself as a dumbass when there's plenty of evidence that proves otherwise is a bad thing. Once again, this is don't use the hacker defense. We'll go a little bit more into how that hasn't worked very well in a couple of case studies, but it doesn't work. You have to be pretty much 90 years old living in a shack out in the forest who manages to have a computer with Wi-Fi. I don't know. But to believe it, for someone to believe it, it's not a good thing. So don't ever, as we mentioned, don't try to set up a system that's your caveat operating system or your caveat hardware set. Use stuff that you're well known for not knowing.
Yeah, it's kind of hard, too, because a lot of people don't know they're dumbasses, and so it's just kind of almost an ambiguous thing. It's just, don't present yourself as a dumbass when, in fact, many of you may be presenting ourselves as complete dumbasses. I mean, actually, considering we're talking about this whole methodology, at this point, none of this applies to us anymore. We've kind of, dumbassed ourselves out of ever using any of this stuff in these slides by giving a public presentation on it. Right. And, we've discussed it. It's like, so we're giving it to you. We're going to take the bullet on this one, and we're just going to make sure. I'll go in the dunk tank for EFF, and, and hopefully, that kind of thing, we won't have to deal with that kind of thing.
That's at 4:30 outside.
and by the way, just so you know, I mean, we prefer that you just don't do something stupid, okay? Simply because there's a lot of bright people in here that are doing a lot of, extremely fun and clever things. But if it reaches the point where you realize you're under an investigation of some type, it's too late to start thinking about, I'm going to go ahead and start doing that, that inode manipulation thing, okay? It becomes obvious during a forensics investigation where you've created these inodes on there, or you created files on your system that makes it look like it's got some type of cool rootkit on there. And then the forensics investigator, and they are, trust me, a lot of them are extremely bright, will go through there and they'll take a look at the listing of inodes and look at the date and time stamps. And you may have some date and time stamps on those inodes you just created from 6 months ago that give you a perfect alibi. However, the inode number itself is not even close to the range where it should be, for example. This can happen, where it's even close to where it should be for other files created during that same time frame. You see what I'm saying? So you can't necessarily, always rely on that. And I mean, yeah, you can do some really low-level type things maybe and get around some of that. Or you can decide I'm going to throw an encrypted file on there of, whatever size every so often and then delete it, and I've got an inode there I can use and I can shove something there. I mean, you can get that's a lot of work, and I know a lot of people don't necessarily want to do that. But, I mean, this is something you have to actually kind of keep in mind as we're going through this.
Yeah, laziness is your enemy.
And yeah. I think we covered that first one. Oh, yeah, this the second one, though. I mean, if you're... if you're going through and you're trying to prove that you're, you know, that you're innocent because someone else popped you, I mean, you know, don't have, and you can't say, well, oh yeah, well this has happened. I mean, I've actually been owned with my own exploits before. I mean, it's a horribly embarrassing, you know, as giving a presentation, you know, saying, here's this, you know, badass way to break in. Then you find out later you got owned by that same supposed badass way. But typically, if there's some like really cool zero day, that you've got, you don't have the source code to that zero day and say, well, you know, that's probably how that other guy that did it got in, and you've got the source code for the damn exploit, and you know, right there in your home directory
or the web log showing that you downloaded the source code or anything like that.
So. Yeah, I mean, it just, you know, it looks, you know, that's not something you want to have happen there. All right, now this is going to be. We wanted to actually. Now we debated on whether doing demos or not. And we thought this actually was going to be a little bit more interesting. We're going to talk about four different cases. Now, our backgrounds, I mean, Weasel's done a lot of forensics work, and he's actually worked and helped take cases. He's basically taken stuff and where it's gone to trial and put a bad guy away or whatever. I think mainly
child pornography cases.
Yeah, and so we're going to take some examples from that, and both of us have done some pro bono work where we've actually helped out some defense expert witnesses to help them fill in the gaps when they hit something that they didn't understand. And so we wanted to talk about some real cases. There's at least a couple of them that hopefully are fairly well known that you've actually heard of that might be kind of interesting, where we know some of the principal players and we can give you a little bit more background on what happened. All of these have a forensics element that's somewhat interesting. I think this is probably, in my opinion, the best part of the presentation, because everything we just talked about kind of is going to start to apply.
And these first two are here, so.
No, this one is. This one's mine. In this one, we had the defendant. It was a child porn case, and the defendant is wanting to go to trial because he's basically saying, because I'm innocent, you know, I'm not taking a plea bargain, I'm not doing any of this stuff, I didn't do it, okay? And without going into, like, the other things, like, there was not any other physical evidence. There wasn't, like, magazines or, you know, printed out pictures or anything like that. It basically was files in a laptop. During the forensics, the original prosecution forensics investigation, they collected a lot of data, but again, this is one of these things where the forensics investigator, he's got 40 other things to get through. He misses that there is a remote access Trojan on this Windows system. And again, also, the guy that's happened to, not real computer savvy, okay? So the defense goes to the prosecution because they've got, like, file listings to start with. And they say, we want copies of these particular files, the binaries of these particular files. They put in the request, and specifically they're wanting the binaries of these Trojans. Shortly after that, the prosecution, and this is right before they are going to trial, the prosecution basically figures out where the defense is probably going to go with this, and they go ahead and drop the case. Okay. Now this is just to give you kind of an. Well, here we'll move on to the next one there. Again, you know, defendant was not savvy. All right. So basically, if you've done something bad, okay, and you're in this room, this isn't going to work. All right. If you're savvy about this kind of stuff, you can't just leave, you know, an old version of Sub 7 sitting there on your computer, because odds are you probably might have checked for it.
Yeah, I mean, that second bullet's kind of funny, but I don't know. Maybe in my jaded way, I heavily believe this. Behind every prosecutor, or I guess in front of every prosecutor, is a district attorney with political agenda, and their stats actually come into play in their career. So I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I just really feel that cases get dropped pretty easily if they look like it's going to be a chore or they're not going to at least get a plea bargain out of it.
Just to give you an idea, in the in the federal court in the New York area, they have a 97% to 98% conviction rate. Okay, so essentially, you know, if you get busted, it's going to be bad. You're almost essentially guilty. All right. Which is why we wanted to bring this kind of stuff up.
Yeah, and running trials costs money, and you know if you're thinking of a prosecution system that's managed like a business, they're not going to invest money in areas where they're going to lose. So,
yeah, and again, the other interesting thing about this though was that the forensics examiner missed this remote access Trojan, and should have caught it. This would be something that, and a lot of times that's one of the things they ask them when they get on the stand. It's like, did you find any evidence of viruses? Is there any type of, back door that had been put there by someone? They ask those types of questions, and this guy had missed that. And that probably right there, because he missed it, was probably why they're going to say, how can you trust the rest of the forensics data? He missed something this obvious, blah, 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 and that's probably
half the reason. The old taillight out on the cop car defense. Is this one yours?
No, that's the one that's in the
All right. This is a case that I helped out with the defense expert by looking at the evidence and so forth. Basically, what the case was that someone was accused of child pornography, trading him in IRC. More specifically, he was using the old IRC F servers, the DCC stuff, to trade and host anonymous trading of anonymous from an access level where people could access his F server and download and upload pornography. So he was found fairly easily because he was allowing anonymous access. He wasn't controlling access to the data that he was sharing. And it came up. I want to think that he was actually found with maybe some bots somebody was running in IRC that was going out and doing analogy on the file names and so forth, and actually found him that way. He claimed seeing black screens and random text appearing. Those of you who know Sub7 pretty well has a little matrix screensaver where you can black out the screen and put text across the top. Really old stuff. It's just for screwing with people. But he basically tried to say, hey, you know, I've got something going on. And he was smart enough to not say, I've got Sub7 on my system. He said, I've got something strange happened on my computer. I don't know what it is. But come to find out, the guy was extremely technically savvy, understood. It was proven that he understood things quite well. He understood all the components of the compromise on his system. And come to find out, he had actually planted the Sub7 on his system. So basically, here's someone that tried to pioneer the digital plausible deniability and failed. And he ended up, I believe, taking an extremely long sentence because of it.
Actually, we were talking about this morning. He got 10 years for this, which in this case is good.
Is that right? Okay.
So basically, we've kind of the main things about this is that, again, the claims of stupidity, I got hacked, that's not going to work. Okay, that is the hacker defense is not a good defense, and it is rarely going to work at all. The prosecutors, if you are going to come up with the hacker defense, the prosecutors are probably going to get even more pissed off and be even more venomous because it just irritates the fuck out of them. Okay.
Right, and I believe in this case specifically, the judge that oversaw the trial saw the hacker defense coming and threw that whole bit out. Said, "I'm not going to allow it. I don't."
Yeah, and I want to make one other comment because you've mentioned child porn in these first two examples, and you're probably thinking, oh, we got these two evil long-haired hippies that are helping out child pornographers in their defenses. I mean, there is such a thing as everyone deserves a fair trial. But the other thing to keep in mind is that in a lot of times, the defense expert witness comes back to the lawyer of the defendant and says, you know what? I found all this stuff. He is absolutely 100% guilty. In fact, I found more than what the prosecutor found. This needs to be, there's no reason to even go to trial. You need to plead this one.
Yeah, they'll plead it out pretty quick.
Because the attorney is going to want to know if their client is telling the truth. They don't often know. And sometimes this is basically how this ends up playing out, is that you've got the defense expert witness who's actually saying, yes, by God, he is guilty. And I can think of in a couple of several instances where a defense expert witness says, I recommend you do not put me on the stand because all I'm going to do is just make things even worse. And this is not just child porn, but in just regular hacking cases as well. Or says, don't put me on the stand. I think the guy's guilty, and that's what I'll say. And they, you know, he went off with his, you know, $5,000, $10,000 fee for being a defense expert witness. And
yeah,
there he went.
Okay. This one you know more about than I do.
Yeah, this one, we have a state senator that's under investigation for fraud in Pennsylvania. This one is fascinating, okay? Absolutely fascinating. Two system admins, okay? They're basically being told from higher up, you know, the senator, they're being told, get rid of all the evidence of our fraud. You know, the guy's doing some kind of goofy, you know, money laundering thing through a nonprofit. It's kind of ugly. If you Google on these people, you'll on their names, I'll give you some information. We've actually got a link to the indictment in here too. It says delete every piece of email that you can. Now, what happened is these guys are running around with PGP wipe. They're running around doing all this other kind of goofy stuff, trying to delete every piece of email they can. And some of the things they forgot to delete was their chatter back and forth in email, like, hey, did you delete Connie's PC with the stuff? And they forgot to delete that kind of stuff. So, but, I mean, it's 65, 70 pages of stuff in there. It is fascinating, and I recommend everyone in this room read that thing because you get to really, really see what it – you can see – you can get into the mindset of what they were going through and – by implication, you see the mindset of why these two guys, from the prosecution standpoint, why these two guys got indicted.
Yeah, it shows where these guys were so focused on covering the tracks for the senator, they didn't think about themselves, and that's how you know they got popped for it.
And what was really even was sad is that, and I haven't been following it here just lately, but these guys were indicted before the senator was.
So the senator right. will be indicted.
Do what? This took place this past May.
Yeah. Yeah, it's still playing out.
It's still, yeah, so it's not done. Anyway, basically, there's a couple of interesting things that you'll gather from reading the indictment. Number one, you run PGP wipe. There is a fingerprint that it actually leaves on the system. It uses it's like there's some type of, there's some temp files and stuff that it uses when it's writing, and it does erase those, but it doesn't do a secure erase of its temp file, okay? So what happens is you can tell with a date and a timestamp when PGP wipe was run. Something to keep in mind, if you're going to be doing PGP wipe on a regular basis for years and years, that's one thing. But if all of a sudden your boss has been in, you know, is under investigation for something, and starting the next Monday, you're running PGP wipe on everything, it's going to look like you're possibly involved in some type of cover-up.
Yes,
yeah,
I've
got
you
got a question.
Does
Cypher
leave any traces behind?
As if Cypher leaves any traces. I don't – my understanding is that it does, but I don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
XP
utility, right? Pardon?
The Windows XP utility that'll
wipe
your drive.
Yeah. Yeah, in a lot of cases, yes, there's certain things they may not be able to identify the specific tool, but they can tell something's been done. You know, where like it depends on the way the wipe's done. If the wipe is like you know, where they do random data in there, or they wipe with, let's say they do a pass with all zeros and then all Fs or something like that. I mean, then it's you can see that. I mean, it'll look pretty obvious that something's been done because in all your in all your free space, you know, especially if it's a tool that goes in and does Slack, file Slack, then it'll see all those spaces in there where things have been putting in there. And it's conceivably, if it's random data, I mean, I don't know if they want to do this. Maybe some defense expert people might want to keep this in mind. In theory, you could run some type of analysis on the data to say, is this random? Does this look like there's a pattern to it? Is it more random than this other's part? You know, that kind of thing. But again, that's the thing that gets really interesting from our perspective. But remember that the jury is like your grandmother and whatnot. And so they're just going to hear a bad guy did something. And a guy in a suit is telling me that he has positive proof that I don't understand that he did it.
Yeah, and I wasn't smart enough to get out of jury duty, so.
Which we're going to touch on in a minute. Right, we don't think that's, we think actually, well, we'll get to that in a minute. But the thing is, you know, the admins, just so you know, in this particular case, and you know how, like, you know, the DOJ really likes to make the numbers look big because when it comes to budget time, it looks good when they're saying these big numbers. But, like, for these two guys, one of them's, like, 50 years old. The other one's, like, 36 years old. One of them, and this is in the goddamn press release, it says, you know, he could spend $495 years in jail and $7.5 million in fines, and the other guy is like, you know, he's getting apparently a pretty easy deal. He's only got, you know, 25 years. And
why did I take that CompTIA exam?
Yeah, I mean, now granted, it's not, they're not going to give a guy, you know, 500 years for you know, wiping emails, but I mean, you get the idea. I mean, it's looking grim, and they really stack it up to where it looks really, really ugly.
They want to scare the shit out of those two for obvious reasons.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're going to go back and basically roll over on the senators. What they're going to do? Anyone recognize this one? The Zezoff or whatever it is. This is the guy. This is the Michael Bloomberg case. And this is where this came down, I guess, just fairly recently, last year or two. Anyway, this particular individual, and this is before Michael Bloomberg became mayor of New York. He ran this big firm. They have this, you know, financial software. This guy over in
Russia.
No, he wasn't from Russia, but he was Russian. But he's in like he's one of the he was in a stan or a Vakia. Okay, one of the stans or one of the Vakias. And I don't remember off the top of my head. Okay, give me a break. But nonetheless, I mean, what this guy did was he found a flaw, and then he was, and it's kind of interesting technically, where there's like normally the software there'd be a login, but then there's like some secondary stuff that goes in under the covers to make sure that the rest of the transaction is going to work. And this guy used like, you know, soft ice and could bypass the first part, which is using the second part. And so he gets into the point where he's in like. Their Solaris, you know, back end system. And so now he's sending emails from Bloomberg to Bloomberg saying, I found holes in your stuff. And Bloomberg forwards it off to, you know, the guy saying, hey, I got this weird message. Can you look into this? And the guy says, no, he sends another message saying, don't send it off to your tech person. I'm telling you, you got to hold me. He's really kind of, you know, he's really fucking with the guy. Right, so the thing that's really interesting about this really hasn't been made public, is that because he's like in a, you know, Kazakhstan or whatever it is that he's in, they confiscate his computer overseas, and this is, you know, after he gets arrested and everything, they confiscate his computer overseas and it's in the possession of a foreign government. Now, there were modifications. Now, the defense expert found that there were modifications made from the time, with a time stamp that was after the seizure by the foreign government, but before it was turned over to the U.S., who did the forensics investigation. So the guy has essentially plausible deniability. And the two main threatening emails that came where it's like, you're going to pay me a couple $100,000 and everything. These two emails are like worded slightly different. You know, words are misspelled in these that are not misspelled in all the other emails and that kind of thing. So there's like these things that are created in there that are really the bad stuff. This evidence is not thrown out, okay? They managed to say it's okay to let this stuff in. Now, of course, the bad thing is, of course, it's like, you know, pay me $200,000 and, you know, I'll meet with you and you give me the money and everything like that. What's weird about it is the guy that, if it were convicted him, was the guy still showed up at the meeting with Bloomberg to get his cash, which is when they got him. So, I mean, it's kind of, you know, kind of, it's still kind of stupid. His actions are really what convicted him on it. But nonetheless, had he, you know, If it had just been the threat and they grab him on that, there was evidence there and it was actually thrown out.
Yeah, and I believe that there was speculation by the defense off the record was that maybe this was an agreement between the foreign government and our government to show that they were working together really well. So maybe some evidence was still accepted, even though it may have shouldn't have or anything. I don't know that there was enough there to actually bring up an appeal of any sort. I don't know if there is an actual appeal in the works on that case either.
Yeah, but nonetheless, I mean, you know, you have this, you know, there were politics involved in this. Obviously, you got Bloomberg. It was a big. It was just a circus of a trial. Just Google for the names in here, and you'll find plenty of stuff on it. Also, the other thing to keep in mind, this guy was actually, the defendant was acting nuts in court and was like, you know, yelling and screaming in Russian at people. And
he wanted to wear his jumpsuit, which everybody knows you dress well and look like you're a good, upright, standing citizen. So, see, our motivation not to ever get busted is because we don't want to cut our hair. So,
that's essentially it.
So there you go. But yeah, he was acting erratic. The guy had been in jail for 2 years waiting for the trial, and his family showed up, and the kid was in the court. His 2-year-old, or I guess 3 or 4-year-old son was in court, and he went barreling through the court to jump over to hug his kid, and that was just looked really poorly to the jury because they intercepted him before he got there, so it looked like he was trying to make a dodge for the door and all this stuff. So yeah, his behavior was very damaging to him, to the jury. Yes.
The question was, so are you saying that Mudge got busted, that's why his hair's short? You'll have to ask Mudge that question. Either that or he's now busting people. We haven't decided which one it is.
Mudge is a fed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, here's another useless slide. We took this yesterday right before Bruce spoke of Bruce's crotch, and so we just thought we'd throw it into our presentation for no apparent reason. All right, so a few conclusions here. Again, as I mentioned, if you can control the bits and bytes in your computer, and read that indictment for sure, but if you can control the bits and bytes of an investigation, you can kind of control the flow of it. But you have to act now if you want to control the flow of it. And quite frankly, I'd recommend you do it now, whether you think you're going to do anything bad in the future, whether you know you're not going to do anything bad in the future, because you really never know. I mean, the whole design of this is if you're living under a repressive regime, that you may want to do this because you're starting to lose some trust in the government, and that is happening to a certain degree here. It could get better. It could get worse. I'm not giving an Annie Bush thing because I thought Clinton was a dick too. But, I mean, yeah. Well, I mean, hey, come on. I mean, you know, there's some, you know, when you have, you know, pardon? Yeah, clipper chip. Someone. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, clipper chip. Let's see. DMCA. Whose watch was that on? I mean, come on. I mean, there were some bad things that have gone. And then
USA that was drafted at the same time.
Yeah. USA Patriot. I mean, all these things. I mean, you know, it's kind of scary time. So we may have to actually try to do some of these things. Now, again, I mean, we're just talking about mainly the forensics thing. We can't tell you how to walk and talk and act and behave, okay? But if you're going to walk the walk and talk the talk of a good model citizen because you don't want to get caught, then actually do it. You know, I guess don't give up, give talks on DEF CON about thwarting government investigations might be a good start. But you see what I'm saying? You get kind of the idea. And even the best stuff you do, if you're like, you know, bragging to your buddies about it that, hey, I popped this box, I mean, that's just, you know, that's kind of stupid.
Do it to learn, not to brag.
Exactly. And the last point on here, and I encourage everyone to do this. Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, show up in a suit and tie and try to actually participate and actually see what goes on in a court. Because it is conceivable that if something does happen to you, I think it's a good idea for all of you to meet your jury of peers, okay? It can be an enlightening and very frightening experience.
Again, it's a large or a group of people who were not smart enough to get out of jury duty.
Yeah. So go in there. I say go in there and learn something. Educate these people while you're in there as well. I mean, go in there and actually participate. Yes, we got the EFF not heckling, which is pretty good. We can do a quick Q&A. So this is what happens when Weasel's working on slides while watching CNN. Okay. So if anyone's got some questions, there's a mic up there. We got time for just a few. Yes. The presence of encrypted files. It could be considered evidence against you if you have encrypted files on your system.
You encrypt everything, not just the good stuff.
Yeah,
that's just
all right. Okay, you encrypt your porn, encrypt your encrypt meaningless logs,
RFCs,
encrypt, whatever you want. You are welcome to encrypt anything you want, and it's been done where people have actually pled the fifth instead of giving up their PGP. Passphrase. Now, in case there is something in there, okay, that you really don't want them to be looking at. I mean, it's worked. Okay, it was Mitnick, and we all know how shitty that turned out for him. But I mean, nonetheless, you can do that if you want, okay? And they didn't tack on extra time for not turning over his passphrase. Yeah, you should be using everyone should be using encryption anyway, okay? For the same reason, if we see something, some technological piece of doodad that we want to play with simply because we're hackers, that's what we do. You should encrypt for the exact same reason, because you can.
Yeah.
Yeah, question?
Basically, I'm kind of curious. You're talking about putting stuff in beforehand, but I mean, if you're putting in a rootkit to prove that, give yourself some plausible deniability, don't you really need to also have that rootkit actually doing something like collecting your passwords and other things that actually makes it look like it's something other than just a random rootkit that didn't really do anything?
Sure, not one file. Yeah, you want to layer all of the stuff that you're doing. You want to create deleted files that were created and deleted by the rootkit.
Yeah, and even something like a rootkit that appeared to be active for 3 or 4 months.
Well,
and then is no longer active. I mean,
show up in your ISP logs as a zombie for a little bit.
I mean, then you do something else, and then you do something else, and you just layer these things on. I mean, that's what we're talking about. You can't just leave a copy of it lying on there. Now, if you're clever, you may leave a copy of it something lying on there that, when pulled out inside of a forensics investigation, it's like what would be a natural remnant of someone who really hid stuff well. Okay, mm-hmm. And there's this little piece that's left. You may even want something like that as well.
Now, as a part of doing something like this, I mean, that requires a lot of effort and follow-up and chasing it down. And isn't it just simpler to, as you were just saying, encrypt everything, make sure that that's your habit, that's your practice, and then, if you get popped, just plead the fifth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Use the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, and I brought this last slide. Bruce Potter still isn't in here, is he? Okay, good. This is what I want everyone to do, all right? take pictures of his crotch, okay? Send him to this email address.
Yes,
you certainly don't
too.
Have a question about his crotch, do you, Dan? We don't have anything against his crotch. It's just that we use a couple
Except
of these
our cameras. Our
yeah.
cameras are against his crotch.
Yeah, send us pictures to this email, and we got an idea for some stuff that we'd like to do. Okay, don't tell him why you're doing it. Just take a picture
of
his crotch.
This is a secret. Don't tell Bruce. No
yeah,
one.
Yeah, don't
we
tell
trust
Bruce
you.
That we did this.
You're in our group, and okay. We're over here. We're the cool people who take pictures of Bruce's crotch, and then there's the rest of you. But anyway, okay.
All right. The next question.
Yeah, earlier on you were talking about the lost key syndrome.
Yes.
Given your experience in forensics, what is there an approach to take in evidence creation where they're more likely to find one particular thing earlier on?
I'll touch on this. Right now, maybe not. But I think everybody can agree with me that universities will soon be turning out in-case jockeys, and investigations probably won't go beyond that tool. So if you understand the tools that are going to be used against you, then you know exactly what you need to do.
That's pretty much it. The best example I can give is, you know, if you're a Linux guy, you know, you put all the bad stuff happening on your Windows box or vice versa, okay? The system you don't know as much about. It's a good learning experience. You get to learn a new operating system. It increases your skill set. And maybe you'll throw the bad stuff on yet another operating system that comes along later on. Basically think about what they would grab and then go from there.
Thank you.
Earlier you mentioned something about the fingerprint of, well, PGP white. Have you done any or are you aware of any research into things like what a hard drive looks like when it's fresh from the manufacturer? Perhaps writing tools that restore a hard drive to look like it's never been written to.
I've done a little bit of stuff in that arena, and that is that a lot of Googling and whatnot. Peter Gutman, who's actually here at this conference, did a paper a number of years ago that talked about, you know, the drive and how you should do, like, you know, 27 passes and whatnot. Technology has changed so much. Drive technology has improved so much since that paper. He's one of the first ones to say this doesn't apply anymore. And so to get it to a state to where it's back to the way it was, so to speak, is fairly easy to do, okay, with conventional wiping tools, okay? And you can use stuff like, PGP does have, they've got other tools for assisting in this. There's other people that have tools for assisting in this, where you can actually go through there and actually really, you know, zero the thing out. You don't have to do the, and by the way, just because I do know a little bit about this, I've spoken to both the people that developed the NSA, the NSA person that developed the standard for wiping. It is not seven passes. It's three, okay? They say seven passes a lot of times because there was a product that was approved for use in the government that happened to do seven passes. It did four extra, so it met the criteria. So everyone says, I'm government, you know, certified, I do seven passes. Three passes is enough. You do once with zeros, you do once with FFs, and then you do a random character that you verify that you've read and write back from the drive to verify it's actually there, and that's considered good enough for pretty much anything. And you're certainly, yeah, again, you're going to thwart the in-case jockeys or whatever with that stuff gone.
Yeah, but are drives coming from the factory with randomness, or are they coming with all zero?
Oh,
that's what I mean.
No, there'll be some data on there because they'll do some stress tests and stuff like that. Now, yeah, conceivably you could fingerprint and say, okay, they use these types of tools to test the drives, so we're going to have these types of bytes on there. Conceivably, yeah, you could write a tool that actually did that.
I haven't heard of a tool yet, so.
Okay.
That'd be a fun thing to do.
All right, thanks.
All right.
I think we've been cut off, but
One more question from John.
I'm John Callis. I'm CTO at PGP. I was going to say that just about all wiping programs have some sort of passive fingerprint that you can tell what wiping program was done on it. And they are also not designed to make it look like your disk was not wiped. To do that, you would need to, after you do your three passes or whatever, then do an additional pass that layers over some data that looks like the disk was not wiped. If you want to regularly wipe your drive, you are much better off having some sort of cron job or something else that that wipes it 3 a.m., 5 a.m. every Sunday, and say, this is my policy, I wipe it every week, than you are to wipe it once. It is the wiping it once right after something bad happens that is a huge signal.
Yeah, again, that's
exactly.
Speaks to exactly what we've been saying, so thank you.
All right, thanks, Sean. All right, we've cut off. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks, everyone.